from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Philip Kaufman, the San Francisco-based director of critically acclaimed films such as The Right Stuff, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and Henry in June, will join us in the studio for the hour, and we'll look back at his career and discuss his newest release, an epic film for HBO about the marriage of writer Ernest Hemingway and journalist Martha Gellhorn. Hemingway and Gellhorn was shot largely in San Francisco and Oakland. Philip Kaufman joins us as part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters who make the Bay Area unique. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Philip Kaufman is one of the nation's leading filmmakers, an internationally acclaimed director of 13 films, which includes such standouts as The Right Stuff, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Henry in June, and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. His first film, Goldstein, won the Cannes Prix de Nouvelle Critique back in 1964, and he recently returned to Cannes, where his newest film, an HBO production, Hemingway and Gellhorn, received a thunderous ovation. It also was screened last Sunday in San Francisco at the Castro and premiered on HBO Monday night. It will be running, in fact, on HBO throughout this week. In April, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City had a retrospective on Phil Kaufman's work, and Columbia film professor Annette Insdorf, author of books on famed directors Truffaut and Kieslowski, recently published a volume on Philip Kaufman in the University of Illinois Press's Contemporary Film Director series. Chicago-born Philip Kaufman has lived for decades here in San Francisco and joins us in studio for this Forum Hour as part of our ongoing first-person series, which focuses on the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters who make the Bay Area unique. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Michael.
And full disclosure, I am a fan and a longtime friend of Phil Kaufman's. I couldn't be more thrilled for the success in the Castro. I mean, it was just, I was there Sunday night, and it was spectacular. I mean, the reception and the love for you as a San Franciscan, as a director, and the excitement about this movie with its remarkable epic sweep, if I may say so. Thanks. 8 years in the making?
Yes, 8 years. Developed the script. Did a lot of work with Jerry Stahl, who was the final screenwriter on it. And it originally was going to be a feature film. And then when Picture House went out of business, their parent company, HBO, asked us if we thought we could do it for television.
And, well, the old anthem was, it's not television, it's HBO.
Well, that's why we did it, really. And you know, and it wasn't really in their sort of standard kind of, you know, program format. They usually go for things of more contemporary relevance and so forth. But a guy named Len Amato, who came out of Feature Films, read that, called me and said, would you be willing to do this for television? And
do this for a shoestring, he made clear. I mean,
he stood
up there at the Castro, and he's the president of HBO Films now, and he said, I don't know if we can make this film, but part of it takes place. It's about Hemingway and Gellhorn. Some of it's in Finland, some of it's in Cuba and so forth. Phil said, don't worry, we'll do it, right?
I mean, right. If we can do it all, I see the whole world here in San Francisco when I walk around. Well, having sold them on that idea, then we had to find the whole world here. But I, you know, I love the city, and when we did The Right Stuff, for example, people said, "Well, you can't shoot the John Glenn parade here," where we were also matching the original archival footage of John Glenn's parade in New York, but we had to put in Ed Harris and you know, the other actors and match them sort of seamlessly with that parade, and we did it here, and we did so many things here. And not only do we have all the, you know, variety of locations in San Francisco, which is extraordinary, but in terms of particularly with Hemingway and Gellhorn, the casting, when we, you want to go to China, we've got China here. We've got, you know, the extras. We've got the streets and Chinatown, the streets we shot in, really match with a little decoration China of that period of 1941.
And a lot of local talent like Joan Chen and Peter Coyote and so walk-ons by Robert Mailer Anderson and Michael Pritchard. I mean, but you did a lot in Oakland too, didn't you?
Yes, the old Oakland, train station. Right, the old train station, which was really abandoned. It's that huge old, you know, some people will remember it when it was a running, a working station. But when we went in, it was just full of graffiti and water and dead animals and odd fecal matter of all sorts. It was really, you did not want to walk into the place. But as we looked around, it, you know, a little, we could hear a little music off in the distance. We just thought, this really, the size, the enormity of the size and the architecture sort of spoke of those grand hotels of Europe. And in Madrid, Hemingway, Gellhorn, Robert Capa, all the correspondents hung out in these big hotels, and the front was only 12 blocks away.
Well, in fact, they met at Sloppy Joe's in Key West, Hemingway and Gellhorn. And you were talking about getting Ed Harris and all in the parades. Extraordinary. One of the extraordinary things about this film is not only the footage you have from the Spanish Civil War and from the Allied invasion and from the Japanese invasion of China and so much, but also the character. Nicole Kidman and Clive Owen, by the way, are the two stars of this film. Mm-hmm. They're right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're in those scenes, those documentary footage scenes.
Right. Well, you know, in the past, you know, working particularly, say, on Unbearable Lightness of Being with Walter Murch, we had the Czech invasion, the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, and we matched Daniel Day-Lewis and Juliette Binoche into the stock footage with all sorts of, you know, graininess and color transitions to match the original footage. But in this film, right from the beginning, we use techniques that, you know, are available, but I don't think I've ever seen in a feature film. We use them wall-to-wall, a process that we sort of call nesting, where you could put Clive Owen and Nicole Kidman, Hemingway and Gellhorn into the past. And we were able to work with Phil Tippett Studios here in a Phil Tippett's an old friend of mine, and I went and asked him. I said, I just need some bright young guy who will just follow, you know, the instincts that I and we have and try to find a way to nest these people into this archival footage. We had hundreds of thousands of feet of footage. And Phil Tippett said, I couldn't even finish talking. He said, you mean Simo? I said, what? He said, Simo, Chris Morley, who works at Tippett, and he's a brilliant guy. And the whole Tippett studio is just full of these young geniuses. And the whole Bay Area is full of, you know, geniuses, but in the digital world. But Simo worked with us for over a year, you know, putting our people into the past.
Talking to Philip Kaufman, who's new. Film is out on HBO. It's called Hemingway and Gellhorn. And although the name Hemingway comes first, and certainly in the mind of many literary and non-literary people, they think of Ernest Hemingway as being what he was, larger than life. This is really, in some ways, more Gellhorn's movie, isn't it?
It is Gellhorn. You know, if we can say she's the discovery of the movie, it's sort of odd because in her day, Gellhorn was certainly, you know, a well-known writer. She was on the cover of magazines. But as time went on, she sort of became
Hemingway's third wife.
The third Mrs. Hemingway. Yeah. And as she says somewhere, she didn't want to be a footnote to this man's life. And many people regard her as the greatest war correspondent of all time. Marie Colvin, who was just recently tragically killed in Syria, the woman, remember, with the eye patch, hosted a BBC documentary that we saw dozens of times on Martha Gellhorn. She was the narrator and walked around talking about Martha Gellhorn, her influence, and so forth. And when she went into battle zones, she carried a copy of Martha Gellhorn's The Face of War, which is a great book. I recommend it to everyone to read.
Of course, Martha Gellhorn was working as a war correspondent at a time when women were not really deemed to be appropriate to be war correspondents. In fact, she had to kind of become a little bit of an impersonator of Clara Barton or a nurse of some to get over to the Allied invasion.
Yeah, she just had to be. She was bitten or smitten by, you know, that thing once. And learning a lot of this from Hemingway, let's be fair about that, some, you know, writing styles, how to behave in battle. Of course, in our story, she surpasses the master. She is the bearer of the Hemingway code. If there is a manly code, Hemingway, you know, struggled all his life to live up to that. But Martha Gellhorn, in fact, did and went on 30 years after Hemingway's death, well into her 80s, to be at war zones all over the world, and was fantastic. And she wrote, I hate to say, with a woman's insight, if there is that, but the sense of details, of understanding war, understanding the human suffering in war in a way that many male correspondents didn't, and she was incredibly important.
But the picture also gives us a realization of who and what Ernest Hemingway was and all of his bluster and macho and bravado and all of his sheer appetite for life. I mean, there's tenderness in Hemingway, too. Those of us who have studied his work know that. And you bring that out and bring out certainly the passion of this love affair. And one of the trademarks of your work, a lot of the sensuality as well that we associate with movies like Unbearable Lightness of Being. I was also struck, you're talking about Hemingway and his code, at that there's a scene in there, I don't want to give too much away here, but the scene with Robert Duvall where they're doing a little bit of Russian roulette. And you actually, your history with Duvall goes back to 1971, I guess.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of these actors, you've
right, been... Right, right. No, you know, Bobby Duvall played Jesse James in the Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid, which was, he was pretty much unknown at the time, really hadn't had a lead. He was amazing. We had a marvelous time working together. He did a little cameo in Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Pretty good as a Russian general, too. You got Tony Shalhoub and Robert Duvall as Russians in this movie.
Yeah, no. And Duvall said, Phil, I want to come. I'll work with you. I love this thing. He had a great time here. But he said, I won't take any credit. I said, come on, Bobby. You got to. He said, no credit. That's the deal. So he doesn't have a credit on the film. He just came to be – he loved the script. He loved – you know, we're great old friends. And, in fact, many years ago, I used to let him beat me in tennis occasionally.
That sounds like Hemingway. I let him beat me. You're talking to Philip Kaufman, who, by the way, a screenwriter, director, and a lot of people don't know actually with George Lucas came up with the original story for Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, long time ago.
Long time ago. I mean, there's a career here of such variety, and they always say that about you. I mean, your admirers always say that because of kind of. I mean, you've been a literary filmmaker in many ways, turned on by books that you want to see brought onto the screen, but also somebody of just really eclectic taste. Something ignites, and you go after it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm trying to learn things. I mean, I guess that's part of it. You know, people often say, why don't you make, you know, a genre film over and over again? I mean, I've made Westerns, I've made thrillers, I've made all kinds of things. But I really, you know, for me, the thrill is getting involved in a project. When we did The Right Stuff, I spent, I don't know, 5-6 years getting immersed in Tom Wolfe's book and the history of the thing and archival footage. And
Learn a lot about space, too.
Learn a lot about space. I mean, in fact, when we went to France to open the film, We were just returned from France from the Cannes Festival, and I was laughing with my son Peter. We were on the front page of Nice Matin, where I was sitting in a French jet giving them the thumbs up sign as if I was the ultimate expert on, you know, flying and stuff. But, you know, having done that, I want to move on to something else. I try to follow. I'm just trying to learn things, really.
Well, you've learned a lot and taught us a lot in the process. And this has been, you mentioned Peter, this has been a family operation. I mean, Peter producing a number of the films, your wife, late Rose Kaufman, Rose Fisher Kaufman, being involved in the screenplays. Right. And Peter's sitting in the control room now with your grandson, Octavio. Is he looking toward a film
Octavio?
Life? Octavio?
Well, you know, Octavio, I think, has a very promising thing. In fact, he has a little role in Hemingway and Gellhorn. You know, we went into, of course, all of this is taken out of Gellhorn's writings and Hemingway's writings and so forth. But she went to Finland and is, you know, talking about in her writings about this 10-year-old Finnish boy looked up at the sky and he saw the Russians invading. And he said, little by little, I'm becoming very angry. And that's Octavio, the Finnish boy. I guess, was that finishing school?
Oh. Well, that would have made it in Herb Cain back in the day. You know, you're talking about taking out of writings by Gellhorn and Hemingway. I mean, those of us who are sort of know our Hemingway, there are lines in that movie. You know, you can almost say, that's where that was from, that's where
right, and so forth.
I mean, that was, on Jerry Stahl's part, I guess, intentional.
Well, yeah, all of us. I mean, you know, it was how much of the real dialogue can we put in? Now, some people may feel, well, that's, you know, Hemingway, did they really talk like that? Well, they did, sort of, when you go back to, I mean, these lines are, and they, you know, they're right out of Hemingway, right out of Gellhorn, and the actors played them beautifully. They play on the screen. And but when you look at the films of the 30s, this was the type of dialogue. I mean, they were of their time. Somebody, I think it was Bill Buford, who said that Martha Gellhorn was, just paraphrasing, you know, she was tall, leggy, and very beautiful. And she had all the qualities of Lauren Bacall, only she was more beautiful and smarter. And I didn't know there was anyone more beautiful and smarter than Lauren Bacall. But this was, you know, Gellhorn. And when you look back at, you know, Bogart and Bacall and all those movies, or you look at Clark Gable, and, you know, people can say, well, did he influence Hemingway? Well, the opposite was certainly true. They were friends, as was Gary Cooper. But Hemingway was writing in, you know, the early 20s. He influenced a whole style of talk and of behavior, for better or for worse. There was
a literary style, which, I mean, is so distinctive that it's had impact on particularly American writing. Hemingway used to say, you know, all American literature goes back to Huckleberry Finn, but so much of modern American literature goes back to Hemingway.
Yeah. Now somebody, I mean, certainly J.D. Salinger, Norman Mailer, Jim Harrison. I mean, on and on and on. Somebody said every American writer after him was influenced by him, except possibly Vladimir Nabokov.
Who was not American-born, but Faulkner.
Right, right, I know that was.
I think Faulkner had his own.
Well, Faulkner was a contemporary.
Style,
I'm saying about
afterward. Yeah.
I mean, and Hemingway, of course, with Faulkner, Dos Passos, Steinbeck, everybody. You know, he had to get into the ring with those guys. I mean, those were his competition.
In the movie, he bullies David Strathairn, plays John Dos Passos, and perfectly in character with Ernest Hemingway, bullying other writers the way he did.
Right. Right.
But there's, again, you caught the tender side of him too. That moment that, and I don't want to spoil too much of the plot here, but that Gellhorn knows she's in love with Hemingway.
Right.
He's talking to a man who's wounded in the Spanish Civil War, and that was the other side of Hemingway. There was even an androgynous side of Hemingway, as you well know.
Yeah.
Talking again with Philip Kaufman. Let me open the phone lines, by the way. Some of you who may have seen the movie on HBO or seen it here at the Castro, maybe even saw it at Cannes, or know Phil Kaufman's work, and this is an opportunity to speak to really one of our leading filmmakers and one of San Francisco's finest. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, and you can become a part of this program. You can do it by phone, as I said, toll-free at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And you can also, of course, communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. I was thinking about your career. I've been sort of in retrospective myself about all the really wonderful films you've made and the variety of films you've made and so forth, and realizing that you went to work for Universal way back when. And I was thinking, I wonder what Phil – we've never talked about this. What Phil thinks about the old studio system as opposed to now going to a place like HBO or having Sherry Lansing – I guess Twisted was the result of – ongoing studio system, but it's broken down, really, hasn't it?
Well, I guess so. I you know, I live up here. I really, during the making of this film, I never went to L.A. once. In fact, you know, during the years Rose was not well, you know, 5-6 years, I never went down to L.A. at all. I live up here. I don't know. There is that studio system. I've been there. I've been under contract to studios, and I made a couple of films through that system. But generally, you know, it's in many ways not for me. You know, it's just not the way of, you know, that I like.
Well, you and Lucas and Coppola managed to keep your distinct identities separate from that world here.
Those guys came up as part of a group, including Walter Murch. I was up here earlier. John Cordy had been here. I was here back in the early beginning of the 60s trying to write a novel and living up here. We loved San Francisco, and we just always wanted to come back to San Francisco. And I'm just thinking of, you know, in a number of movies I make allusion to, even in The White Dawn up in the Arctic, Timothy Bottoms is talking to the Eskimo or the Inuit girl, and he's talking about San Francisco or the way The Wanderers ends, where the two boys are riding off and they're leaving New York, and there's a sign we put up on the road that says San Francisco, 2,652 miles.
That was not in the Richard Price novel.
Richard Price novel.
In fact, that novel was discovered by Peter, wasn't it?
Right. Peter was about 12 or 13. He read The Wanderers. And he said to me and Rose, you know, you got to – this make a great movie. Yeah, Peter, sure. And then we, you know, really – I remember one day Rose was, you know, playing Dion's music and she's dancing around and she said, you know, the kid's right. And we spent years trying to, you know, get that done, because in those days there was a real prejudice against teenage movies. I mean, studios – here we're talking about the studio system. All the experts, the people in the know said nobody wants to see a movie about teenagers. But they also at that time – this goes way back – were saying – and nobody goes to movies in the summertime, so you can see what they knew.
Where were they prescient?
Right, yeah.
We're spending the hour with Philip Kaufman. This is part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and other compelling people who make the Bay Area unique. His new film is called, and executive producer is Peter Kaufman. One of the stars is here with us, too, grandson Octavio. The film is called Hemingway and Gellhorn, and you can see it on HBO, and perhaps will be released on DVD and perhaps to theaters. That's all up ahead, but all up ahead also are your calls, emails, and web comments and Facebook comments. Stay with us here on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Philip Kaufman, the San Francisco-based director of critically acclaimed films such as The Right Stuff, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and Henry and June. which, by the way, was the first NC-17 rating film. We're looking back at his career, discussing his newest release. It's an epic film that was done for HBO about the marriage of writer Ernest Hemingway and journalist Martha Gellhorn, shot largely in San Francisco and Oakland. And he is part of our first-person series on leaders, innovators, and other compelling people who make the Bay Area unique. You can join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, if you have questions or comments for Phil Kaufman, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And boy, the two actors who star in Hemingway and Gellhorn, including Nicole Kidman, who I guess David Thompson still drools over. He wrote a whole book about his attraction to her. Sometimes it was difficult for you to say, or you almost forgot to say cut with these two things. You're so intense.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, I guess one of the things I if I have any talent or skill, whatever, I like being an audience and responding to things, you know, not necessarily getting out with the bullhorn and saying you must do this way and so forth. I mean, we have long talks and rehearsals, but when you can't account for what's going to happen in the moment, actors hold back a little. But with Nicole Kidman and Clive Owen, when they had some scenes, I would just be sitting there and they would play the scene, and I really would be so absorbed in what they were doing that I would forget to say, cut. I'm the director. Cut. You know, they would sort of run out of nice watching them.
But you're also a very collaborative director. I think it's a testament to the kind of directing you do, or the kind of auteur you are, that Clive Owen said he had his family there in making this film, and he said they have never felt more comfortable working in a working situation. Nicole Kidman said, in effect, anytime Phil Kaufman wants me, I'm there for him. That says a great deal when you have the actors, that kind of respect and love of the actors. This actually started, speaking about actors, this whole project started with James Gandolfini, didn't it?
Well, it started before James
Gandolfini. But he had the property.
He was sort of thinking at some point, he read the script and could he play it and so forth. But he came out a number of times and he never felt he could really do it. It would have been quite a different movie with him. But as the Hemingway, you know, evolved and Jerry Stahl started working with us and so forth, Gandolfini just sort of became one of the executive producers. He had brought it originally to HBO and Picture House, where it was going to be a feature. But he was, he just stayed, just wished us the best and,
stayed out of your way.
Stayed out. I said, Tony Soprano, back off, baby.
Well, it's that Chicago background of yours.
No. He was great. He really,
they keep talking about
support.
The president Chicago background, you know, from the right particularly. This film has really kind of an anti-fascist feel to it, too. That comes across. And I was reading that book that was done, published recently by Annette Insdorf, and she talks about the sensuality in your film. She talks about the artistic creation. These are major motifs that she kind of hones in on the way academics do, but also codes of honor and freedom from manipulation. I thought, boy, that in this film particularly comes across in the Gellhorn-Hemingway relationship, because, you know, he wants to essentially have her for himself and not have her go off and be a war correspondent.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sort of a paradoxical thing that he has, because when she first walks into Sloppy Joe's, it's almost as if a character, a woman, Lady Brett Ashley from The Sun Also Rises, his own character walks into his life, a woman who is free and vibrant and sassy and has all of those great strong qualities that women, particularly in the movies back in the 30s, had. And the irony in a way is that he falls in love with her, but he he can't take, he doesn't want that. He wants, when he meets her, he's with Pauline, who is sort of his muse, his, in some ways, his financier.
His good Catholic wife.
Right. And she's created a little museum for him with the heads on the wall and everything. And after Martha, he meets Mary, who sort of, you know, takes him up to Idaho and, you
know. Excuse me, that's Parker Posey, in fact.
It's Parker Posey, the great Parker Posey. And so he sort of wanted a woman who would take care of him, even though he claimed and part of deeply in his heart, he wanted that woman that was inside of him that he wanted to write about. And that was Gellhorn. I mean, she was an amazing, amazing woman.
They say the most courageous woman I've ever met.
That's an actual line of Hemingway's, yeah.
A lot of people want to talk to you. I want to get to our callers here. But say something, if you would, about just the difficulties or the challenges of making a film in the Bay Area as opposed to going up to Vancouver, as so many filmmakers do.
Right.
I remember when Gavin Newsom was mayor, Robert Redford called in and he said there's so many obstacles to try to make a film
right,
here.
Right.
But you did it.
Well, we did it. You know, I've done it before. There are obstacles. There's, you know, in many ways more expensive here, more expensive in the States. I mean, people want to go to Romania and all over the world. I mean, other states, Louisiana, Michigan, even New York give bigger rebates. We went, you know, Gavin was mayor at the time, and the people in his office were fantastic, the Port Authority. They gave us, certain offices over in sort of the Dogpatch area around Pier 80. And we had these big, empty, freezing warehouses that we built stages in. The city really cooperated to, and I think more and more they're discovering that, you know, millions of dollars come into a city when you make movies, and the movies leave and the money stays. And also, if you make certain kinds of movies, like, say, Twisted or something like that, people see locations there and, you know, they come and tourists come. It's just a great thing to have films made here. And there's such a talent pool, not only of actors. You think of all the theater groups. And I love to tap into those things, the extras.
That was a great party you threw afterward, by the way. And they were all there.
Well,
even had some of the Cuban dancers from the movie.
Yeah. I mean, we actually had thousands of extras from the Bay Area here. But, you know, you have the construction workers. We have the best post-production in the world. Laura Hirschberg up at Skywalker has done many movies for us, and she's won Oscars. She's, you know, a genius. And Walter Murch and the whole editing crew, you know, small crew of brilliant people. Walter's son, we call him Tall Walter. Walter's a great big guy, but his son is even bigger. So he's Tall Walter.
Too many to name, even, as
we
say.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's bring some callers on for you, for Phil Kaufman. We go first to Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I really enjoyed the movie. It was really interesting, and I don't know really where to start. One thing I wanted to say is I think Gellhorn comes off a lot better than Hemingway. He's such an arrogant SOB. You said something about tender, and I don't know. I've read all his work, and, boy, he really does disservice to women as far as I'm concerned. But she was just, boy, she was a pistol.
There's a misogynist streak in Hemingway. Let me just speak up for Hemingway for a moment. I mean, in fact, I think it was Malcolm Colley who wrote an article called Pressure Under Grace, because his mother's name was Grace, and she used to dress him a certain way where he looked like a young, like a sister. And he had his problems with women. But there is really, I have to say, a very tender quality to a lot of his work, and especially if you read some of the later work, For Whom the Bell Tolls, which came out of this whole experience that's portrayed in the film and so forth. You see a good deal of that. Thank you, Nancy, for the call. Going to more calls here. Neil, that's you next. Hi.
Yeah, congratulations for doing a good job on making a movie in San Francisco. It kind of brings us back to the film noir days when a lot of movies were made here.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked your reference to the fact that Chinatown of today resembles China of 1940 or 41, which I think is a point that should be remembered as when we consider what the fate of Chinatown should be as the Central Subway is built. However, I am somewhat concerned with your portrayal of Martha Gellhorn in the context of the world of foreign correspondence in general. Now, I've done a good deal of reading on this topic, especially from the World War I through World War II periods and the interwar era, and I don't really think, I think you're doing a disservice when you elevate Gellhorn over so many very great names. I mean, John Gunther and William Shirer and Edgar Ansel Maurer and H.R. Knickerbocker and von Wiegand and on and on and on one could go, Edward Murrow and so on. It sounds a little bit like a process that's taken place with Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. I mean, in back in those days, it was all Rivera, and nowadays it's much more Kahlo. I mean, is this sort of a reflection of the woman's movement that we have to elevate women over men, how does this play out in a way?
Well, I mean, that's those are certainly great reporters. The names that you mentioned, you know, I mean, you can go back to Stephen Crane, you know, who was a great reporter. But in some ways, you know.
And Hemingway was a war correspondent of the first rank, too. Actually.
Right, right, right. But I think what we're talking about, yes, that's a very good point, by the way. You know, it's not to diminish any of the others. When you say for many, she was the greatest of war correspondent because it was the detailing that she did that was different than, you know, the overall view that some of these other correspondents had. Just as when Stephen Crane was writing, you know, in the war, you know, with the Spanish-American War, he went to certain details that set him apart from all the other great correspondents that were there, all of the yellow kids and so forth. And I think she's more in that tradition. And, you know, it's a valid point.
What do you think about the point, though, that maybe there's a tendency? I mean, for example, a lot of writers, Fitzgerald, there's a lot of talk about Zelda now and how much he contributed
to
The Great Gatsby and Tender as the Night and so on.
Yeah. Well, he did dedicate For Whom the Bell Tolls to her. You know, let's just go back to Marie Colvin, who just died in Syria, if you look at the BBC documentary on Martha Gellhorn, you see how much Martha meant to Marie Colvin. And there are the famous correspondents. And then, as we said at the beginning of The Right Stuff about the test pilots who went up and tried to break the sound barrier, these were not guys firing guns. They were trying to do something for whatever reason, and nobody knew their names. They died unknown.
Obscurity.
And that's, I think, Martha Gellhorn and Marie Colvin, you know, or more in that area. But it's a stylistic thing, I think, that people talk about, that she had her own unique style.
And, Neil, we thank you for the call. Let me go to more callers. Michael, you're up next. Welcome.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to talk to you today. I just want to say I saw Hemingway and Gellhorn. I thought it was a terrific film and great storytelling, and I learned so much from it. And I also wanted to say personally thank you, on behalf of all the professional actors in the Bay Area for casting locally, not just this film, but other films that you've made. And I also wanted to know, I know you've talked about the resources here and extras, but could you talk a little about casting principal roles with local actors?
Well, you know, I would love to, you know, we certainly had Joan Chen, Peter Coyote.
And Lars Ulrich.
I met Lars Ulrich from a few years ago. I was doing a project with Sean Penn, And we had a reading in our office with Peter and myself and Sean and his wife. And they brought Lars along to read, who was a pal of theirs, to read some
should
lines.
Should mention this is a guy in Metallica. The rock star.
And Lars did, you know, he read a number of roles. And I said to Peter, we got to use that guy somewhere. He's really got talent. And Lars plays in the film, he plays Joris Evens, the documentary filmmaker. And, you know, I mean, I don't remember Lars ever mentioning Metallica while we were shooting. It was just all about getting into the role and
plays it well, actually.
Plays it really well. But I, you know, on The Right Stuff, we use so many local actors. I mean, of course, we had Sam Shepard and Ed Harris had sort of come out of here, and Fred Ward, and Kathy Baker had never acted before. You know, there's great talent here. And, you know, when you say thank to me for using people, I thank the people for being here. I mean, that's it really is a great talent pool with all the theater groups here. And I mean,
do you go scouting? Do you go to like Berkeley Rep, ACT, and Marin Theater and scout for people?
You know, I go sometimes, but you know, there are local scouting people. You know, when we did The Right Stuff, there was a woman who was my assistant, Patricia de Oliveira, who knew all the Bologna brothers and all of the. I mean, I think we had 135 speaking parts in The Right Stuff, and many, many of them. I mean, we had Scott Beach. We had so many people. Many came out of the Bay Area, and Hemingway and Gellhorn. I mean, there's a guy who plays Chiang Kai-shek, and he's at a table in the film with.
With his teeth.
With Clive Owen, Nicole Kidman, Joan Chen, great actors, and it's Larry Say, who owns the House Restaurant, who's a good friend of mine. And for 20 years, I've been saying to Larry, as I eat there all the time, Larry, you look just like Chiang Kai-shek. And he did it, and he was great.
I guess Gellhorn really did kind of fall for Cho En-Lai, huh?
She did, yeah. All, so much of that is just there's a book she wrote called Travels with Myself and Another. This is after she separated from Hemingway, and there was a bitterness between them. But she's so tender towards him and amused in thinking back. She calls him in that story, UC, unwilling companion. She never refers to him as Hemingway. But a lot of our China episodes come right out of her journals.
But, you know, when you first meet her, and Nicole Kidman is made up in a way that only Hollywood's technicians and the greatness of what they've been able to foment could create.
Right,
I mean,
right.
She looks like Nicole Kidman would look in her post-70 septuagenarian, and there you are with her smoking away and being Martha Gellhorn and talking about how, and these are, I guess, her exact words, she really never liked sex. It was like bread to men, and she gave it to them and so forth. But those scenes are really very sexy and very passionate between them.
Inside
the story,
Well, it's a combination of two things. All of that stuff of the older Gellhorn was taken out of interviews of Martha Gellhorn when she was older. I mean, those are lines just lifted right out of there. And by the way, the makeup was done by a young Japanese guy from Los Angeles, not quite in the Hollywood world, but Nicole, being smart, just knew this guy was great. And he came up in one day and did that. But when you read Hemingway and Gellhorn's letters and correspondence during all of these years, what an incredibly passionate relationship they had. You look at the photos. You look at how they looked at each other. You know, maybe, you know, you start saying, you know, had they lived in a time without war, in another time, things might have turned out differently.
Go to some of our emails. Listener Bruce says, on my way home one day, it was fun to see a ragtag militia leave the front gate of the old train station. 30 people in period costumes on the streets of West Oakland. Owen writes, I wonder how Nicole Kidman was cast in the lead. She has never been much of an actress, much scenery chewed, and in this role she seemed hardly a woman that Hemingway would have been attracted to. Alas, I look forward to the film since I've long admired Mr. Kaufman's work but had to give it up after 15 minutes.
Well, that, you know, can't agree with that.
Everybody's a critic like Hemingway.
Yeah, but Nicole Kidman is a great actor. You know, you look at The Hours. She won the Oscar for that.
Playing Virginia Woolf. In fact.
Playing Virginia Woolf. If you look at The Birthday Girl, which very few people have seen, where she played a Russian hooker, she's done, you know, Diane Arbus. She takes a lot of chances. I mean, people, you know, I think sometimes want to go to her sort of public, you know, relationship with Tom Cruise. Look at To Die For. I thought she was fantastic in that.
Even in that Kubrick film, which I...
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut.
I thought
she was great.
But
you know, everybody has a different take on those things. So maybe, you know, with time passing, I hope this guy goes back and looks at it again, because she really is truly talented.
Well, like I say, everybody's a critic. In fact, everybody seemed wildly enthusiastic about the film when I was in the cast, except the guy who sat next to me. Therein lies a story. But here's Peter, who says, did you have to get any rights from the Hemingway family?
Well, yeah. However, there were, you know, people do all these rites and so forth. I guess whatever was necessary, somebody got. What was really great, though, was that we had an advisor. We had two advisors on the movie who were really tough critics. One was a woman named Susan Beagle, who's a professor and does the Hemingway newsletters. She's right in the heart of all that Hemingway world. And she, you know, reading the script originally, and she had a lot of comments. And, you know, you worry about these people. You know, they have to be totally honest. And the other one was Caroline Moorhead, who wrote the biography of Gellhorn and accumulated her letters and knew Martha Gellhorn really well and, you know, had a lot of cautionary things. Well, they just saw the movie, and both of them raved about the movie. So, you know, some people who think, well, it's not Hemingway, it's not Gellhorn, these are people who really knew these people. And at Cannes, what was amazing, we were at the festival, Gellhorn had two sons. One was adopted, Sandy Gellhorn, and he had gone through some tough times and so forth. I never had met him. And the other was a stepson from another marriage, Sandy. Anyway, her, you know, another stepson. They both came. And when we had this, I mean, it was amazing applause afterwards, you know, standing ovation and so forth. And I leaned over and I shook Sandy Gellhorn's hand, and he just couldn't stop sobbing. And he wrote the letter about it. Just, you know, he felt that Nicole and we got it.
I saw that letter, and it was really very poignant.
Yeah. Sandy Matthews, by the way, it was. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Here's Lenny, who says, Mr. Coffin, which buildings were used around the Bay Area, and did you use Mare Island, and is there a list somewhere?
Oh, well, that's interesting. Mare Island, we scouted a lot out at Mare Island, and it was just, you know, we were on a very tight schedule. We shot a little over 40 days, a big movie. People will remember it was the worst winter in the history of San Francisco, and we were shooting in warehouses that had no heating. You know, fortunately, as I said, during, you know, the love scenes, it was ice freezing. We had little heaters. We had to shut them off when we were shooting, but Clive and Nicole heated the place up. We shot, you know, many places. There are, I think, probably ways of finding all the places.
Well, you remember when Barry Levinson was out here, he shot Sphere.
He shot Mare Island.
Yeah. Here's Mark, who says, great program today. Philip Kaufman is one of the all-time greats. I've always thought that Henry and June is one of the most underrated films of all time, not just of Mr. Kaufman's films, but of all films. The movies... A tour de force of filmmaking, soaring on all levels, acting, directing, art direction, script, character, editing. It's a pure cinematic experience, a whole that exceeds even its mighty parts. It even captures textures and smells. It was one of those all-too-rare films where I left the theater and had to take a deep breath, a sigh, really, and say to myself, now that's why I love the movies.
Oh, man.
I would appreciate hearing Mr. Kaufman share some of his memories and experiences associated with Henry and June.
Oh, well, you know, Henry, I'm so glad. I mean, I love to hear that. It's something, you know, my wife Rose and I spent, you know, couple of years writing.
One thing I think you should mention maybe is the influence of Nias Nin, because
I knew Henry Miller a little, and he was a big influence on me, you know, just going out into the world and going on adventures and going to Europe and so forth. And I met Anais Nin in Chicago before I made my first film, and somehow got to spend a whole afternoon with her and told her some ideas. I was just a young kid, and I remember her just looking at me saying, "You've got to make this into a movie. You've got to make films." And it was great to be able to make a film about Hemingway and Gellhorn based on her journals. Because, some people said, Henry and June. Did I say Hemingway and Gellhorn?
Yeah, that's
right. Some people said, well, Henry Miller, we wanted the Henry Miller of Tropic of Cancer. Well, you know, he's in there, but it really was the Henry Miller as Anais Nin, his lover, which was a secret. People didn't know that, as she saw Henry Miller. And that was, that was the movie we made.
It was a terrific movie. And here's Carol in Sonoma County. Says, "I am most unhappy with caller Neil's comment that the result of the women's movement is to elevate women above men. Having met Mary Hemingway years ago, I gather that Mr. Hemingway recognizes strength in women. Please let the record show that the women's movement is for the purpose of elevating women to be men's equals, not their superiors. And it sounds as though your guest really gets it."
Right.
What's next for you, Phil?
I agree with that. There's just a number of things we've developed over the years. I just haven't had a chance to make some of the projects. You know, it's very hard to get the money. It's hard to find the financing. Clive Owen, after we did this film, read a book that takes place in Shanghai, 1926. And he came over with the writer.
Did he know Peter Kaufman's film on Shanghai?
He does know Peter Kaufman. And we spent days with Clive. He's a great guy. And we're going to try to do the film virtually all in San Francisco through these same processes. Because Shanghai, with all the development, doesn't exist in the same way. And we just are going to really try to do, the full Shanghai with the costumes and the, that sort of questionable Sin City quality where, people lived in the, the foreign concessions. And
well, you've even got the restaurant, Shanghai 19.
Gone.
It's gone. That's
it's gone.
Right. I used to love that restaurant. Good to have you here, and good to have you here,
Michael,
in every sense, not only on film.
Thanks,
one of our great filmmakers.
Here. Thanks.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell and Tina Larberg. Our interns are Keith Manconi, Ernesto Morales, Dana Varinsky, and Catalina Villegas. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.